Biden White House wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal 4 years after President Trump walked away from it. How does Iran see things?
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I think this is the view in Tehran.
Also today, nearly 5 months of fighting in Ukraine has killed thousands of troops on both sides.
The armies are exhausted, but I'm not sure who has the upper hand.
We'll hear from a Ukrainian soldier on the front lines. I'm Marco Werman, and if you haven't noticed already, it's not just gasoline. Hummus is also getting more expensive.
The global supply of chickpeas could drop as much as 20% this year.
Also, rampaging bunnies, the rise of V-pop, and legal cocaine. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad to have you with us this Thursday. On his Middle East tour today, President Biden signed a joint declaration with Israel's leaders. The document is about Iran, an adversary of Israel, and is aimed at keeping Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Iran and its nuclear program have loomed large in much of Biden's discussions in Israel. But how does Iran see the situation? We asked Sina Azodi to help us understand that perspective. He's a non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council in Washington. With talks about a nuclear deal in the background, I asked him how Iran will see today's signed agreement between the U.S. and Israel.
I think that for Iran, it was to be expected. But I think what really distinguishes this statement or President Biden's remarks is that the fact that President Biden announced that he will not take the IRGC off of the FTO list.
The Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran.
Yes, exactly. Even if it comes at the cost of the collapse of the talks, which is quite interesting because, I mean, he will be risking a conflict in the region should Israel decide to take an action against Iranian nuclear facilities, which by default will drag the United States into the conflict.
So the IRGC, as you pointed out, is designated as a terrorist group by the U.S., right?
Yes, it is. But what really annoys Iran is the FTO designation.
What is that?
The Foreign Terrorist List Organizations, which is a State Department list, but the FTO is quite irritating for Iranians.
So why is Iran such a high priority for Biden on this visit?
I think the nuclear program is a great deal for the United States. We have seen that Iran has expanded its nuclear program. It has more knowledge that Iran has, and that knowledge is not reversible. So you cannot really take the knowledge out of the brain of Iranians. They have more technologies. They're closer to a nuclear weapon. They're very close to this threshold of having enough fissile material for one single nuclear weapon. Now, I have to emphasize that this is not the same as having a bomb. It's enough fissile material to produce a bomb should Iran decide to go for a bomb. So the U.S. is increasingly concerned with the new technologies that the Iranians have acquired over the time, new centrifuges that Iranians have introduced. And for Israel, that's a security threat.
So I want to get back to those Iranian capabilities in a moment. But first, for Biden's trip in the Middle East, what have you seen in Iranian state media or from Iranian officials about his trip? What are they focused on?
I mean, if you're sitting in Tehran and you see that a bunch of countries are joining their forces to basically defense against the backbone of your defense strategy, well, it's quite concerning from an Iranian standpoint. I personally think it would increase Iran's insecurities in the region because, as I said, PACT is supposed to counter the threat of Iranian ballistic missiles program, which Iranians have for years invested on.
As you said, Sina, Iran now has the fissile material to get to the next step in bomb making. How likely is it that Iran will race to get the bomb if these negotiations fail and there is no nuclear deal?
The security ramifications will be severe for Iran. One, there's a good chance that the United States would, in support of Saudi Arabia, would deploy nuclear weapons to the region, which Iran will see this as a threat, and it's a quite valid threat. Saudi Arabia may just go ahead and develop its own nuclear arsenal, which is another concern for Iran. So I believe that unless there's a major shift in the security environment, I don't think Iran will go ahead and weaponize its nuclear program. However, that being said, I think Iran has always been interested in having the option of having a nuclear weapon.
So when the original Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, was struck under Biden's former boss, President Obama, it was a long negotiation, but the doors were open with possibility. How different would you say the path of negotiation has been for Biden's White House?
I believe it was 2 months ago that came out that the Biden administration had refused to commit his own administration to stick to the agreement. This is quite worrisome for Tehran that, you know, it enters negotiations, it opens up its economy again, and then there's a good possibility that the sanctions will come into place. When Obama was in power, he was able to come to this understanding that Iran has its own legitimate rights. And the people who were in Tehran also believe that we have to negotiate directly with the United States.
And you're saying this is the thin ice that Biden's White House has had to operate on with Iran, kind of a lack of faith that signatures really have permanence.
The saying goes, you fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I think this is the view in Tehran.
Sina Azodi is a non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council and a professor of international relations at George Washington University. He joined us from Washington. Sina, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
In Ukraine, the mid-sized southwestern city of Vinnytsia is far from the front line of fighting. Since the Russian invasion began, people who lived there thought they'd be relatively safe, until they weren't. This morning, a barrage of Russian cruise missiles launched from a submarine slammed into the city center. Rescue workers scrambled to dig out the wounded from office blocks, apartment buildings, and car lots. At least 22 people died. 3 children were among them. At the same time, in eastern Ukraine, the other side of the country, fighting grinds on. We've been checking in with Ukrainian Corporal Andrei Shadrin, who's serving on the Eastern Front. The 26-year-old medic has been deployed to the Donbas half a dozen times since 2014. He's on the line with us from there right now. Does it seem to you like Russian bombardments are intensifying, or are they easing up a bit?
Thanks to American taxpayers for the HIMARS system, it calmed down the Russian artillery a little bit because we've destroyed plenty of artillery depots all around the front line. But unfortunately, what we get as a result is Russian applying an absolutely terrorist tactics of destroying the civilian infrastructure with hypersonic rockets. We also get a lot of it in the front line.
Andriy, during a single hour, are you able to estimate how many Russian shells you hear landing?
It's coming to infinity. I'm not sure if I even can count, you know, the amount of shells that I didn't just heard. I've seen the explosion, or I can identify the shell as the one that can damage me, because it happens pretty much every day. Each movement of any vehicle can be spotted, and it gives the reaction from the enemy side.
I mean, it's really hard to get a sense of who has the upper hand, but what is clear is that this war is dragging on. Does it seem like both armies are exhausted?
Sure, both the armies are exhausted, but I'm not sure who has the upper hand, because I believe that even if this level of support that we have from the civilized world right now won't even be growing, I think time is playing on our side. Like, you know, Russians, the second army in the world, was fighting for 2 months for the city of Severodonetsk. Who can even find it on the map? And, like, that's kind of not a victory for the second army in the world, I suppose.
The last time we spoke, you were in the Luhansk region. You and fellow soldiers have had to pull back since then and give up Luhansk. What has that meant for morale?
Well, of course, it is pretty upset, for sure, because I don't know any man who will get joy from retreating.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, our first goal is to save the people's life. Maybe 95% of people from Lugansk region were evacuated, which is really pleasant for me. We've saved our units that were operating in the region, and we didn't get encircled because that was a real danger in Lysychansk.
Right. I'm speaking with 26-year-old Ukrainian medic Corporal Andrei Shadrin, who's joining us from a makeshift base in the Luhansk region. As you backed out of Luhansk, did you have to destroy weapons so they didn't fall into Russian hands?
We had plenty of time to evacuate everything that can be evacuated all the equipment that we've got there. And the whole equipment that had to be operational until the last hours of Lysychansk being Ukrainian, it's been mined and destroyed. So, like, it was blown up.
You were in Lysychansk and Severodonetsk just a few days before the Russian troops entered. Those few days, what were they like?
It was an absolute disaster, but we've extracted our forces from the left shore of Seversky Donetsk River, but the Lysychansk just shared the fate of Mariupol and, like, I don't know, maybe tens and hundreds of other Ukrainian cities that've been captured by Russia. So it was just a disaster.
As for what the Ukrainian military needs, you may know that some U.S. officials are wary of sending more weapons to Ukraine before soldiers there can be trained to use them. Is that a legitimate worry?
Well, for sure, to use any new equipment, you get to be trained. Okay, there is some shelling.
Right now?
So, yeah. Yeah. Like, actually, right now.
How close is it?
Pretty close. I even have to run. I don't like it.
Do you want to take some time to? We can call you back.
No. Just a second. I'll just get into the building. There is safer. Okay. So speaking about the trained personnel. So first of all, Ukrainians are sent to the country that is given the equipment, and then they are coming back to Ukraine with the equipment and train the new operators. So the equipment is flowing into Ukraine when we have the instructors to teach new crews for new equipment and new weaponry system.
So, I mean, do you know Ukrainian soldiers who are being pulled off the front line for training? Is that happening?
Yep, sure. I know those guys, and I even have some lessons of English with them sometimes.
I'm sure that helps. So I want to ask you too, Andriy, I mean, you spoke earlier of the mess leaving Luhansk and just kind of the hit on morale. I'm just wondering how you are getting ready just psychologically for the next phase of the fighting, for the battle for Donetsk.
Well, we're already ready. Like, I'm not sure that Russians have anything new to surprise us. We've seen the wall of fire that is devastating everything around you. And, like, what else you got, Russian? Come on. Is there anything you didn't use here? We're just not having enough time to get tired. Or at least realize it.
Mm. When missiles are falling around you, you have to be in the moment. I mean, how do you think about the future? What do you imagine?
When there are shells around you, your future is from the sound of the shell going off the barrel and to time the shell, like, bang, somewhere near you. That's the whole timeline you have. Like, there is nothing before it, like,
yeah.
And after it. There is just nothing you're thinking about. You're just thinking about how to get deeper underground.
Corporal Andriy Shadrin is a 26-year-old Ukrainian medic. He's been stationed in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region for the last 10 months. He's been speaking with us from a makeshift base in the Luhansk region. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Weather and war have hit global supply chains, and one commodity that's now becoming more scarce across the globe is chickpeas, a.k.a. garbanzo beans. Chickpeas are an important source of protein for millions of people in South Asia and the Middle East. In case you hadn't noticed how big the hummus shelf has gotten at your local grocery store, they've also become massively popular here in the U.S. The World's Shirin Jafari has been looking into this. Shirin, are we about to see a hummus emergency?
Marco, when I heard the news, I knew I had to investigate. I am a big fan of hummus. So the first thing I did was I called up my local Middle Eastern restaurant and I asked them if they have any trouble finding chickpeas. The chef told me that thankfully they haven't had any issues. She's been getting the chickpeas she needs. But this is a serious global issue. The world is facing a shortage of chickpeas.
Okay, so break this down, Shirin. What do we know about this chickpea shortage?
So here's where this news is coming from. A non-profit trade organization based in Dubai called the Global Pulse Confederation. has some new data that shows the global supply of chickpeas could drop as much as 20% this year. Now, why is that? There are several reasons. One is that we've been dealing with a global pandemic, and that has impacted everything from production to shipping and distribution. And then last year, several regions that are big producers of chickpeas were hit with bad weather. There was a drought in Midwestern US and Canada. Two other big producers of chickpeas, Mexico and Australia, had also floods, and so their crops were hit too. On top of all this, Marco, we had the war in Ukraine, and that has really impacted the global supply of chickpeas as well as fertilizers that are used in farming. Things got so bad that some countries started to take steps to make sure they have enough chickpeas. Turkey, for example, banned the export of the product last year. I contacted Tuba Memis about this. Her company is one of the biggest exporters of grains in Turkey.
Right now, we cannot export Turkish origin chickpeas. We can only export other origin chickpeas.
So what she told me, Marco, is that her company is importing chickpeas from other countries and then exporting it to its customers because it cannot export its own Turkey-produced chickpeas.
That is extraordinary. Turkey not releasing any of its chickpeas. I mean, how big of a deal is a shortage of chickpeas on people's diets?
Yeah, so chickpeas are a great source of protein, like you said, and they're great because they're much better for the environment than red meat, for example. And they are a major staple in people's diets in places like India, Pakistan, and in countries in the Middle East. But they also have a lot of uses here in the U.S. That's what Tony Ruloffs told me. He's the vice president of Pulse Division at a company called Columbia Grain International.
Into hummus, into canned chickpeas, packaged chickpeas. There's multiple pet food companies that use chickpeas as well.
So, Shirin, are people simply going to have to pay more for things like hummus now?
You might not know it, Marco, but you've already been paying more for hummus.
I didn't notice it.
According to Reuters, chickpeas cost 17% more than they did before the pandemic. Tony Ruloffs of Columbia Grain International told me prices are up because you also have to factor in higher fuel and shipping costs. And he said it could be a year or two before we start to see the chickpea market stabilize again.
The world's Shirin Jafari taking the pulse of the global shortage of chickpeas. Sorry about the dad joke there. Shirin, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco. I see what you did there.
Okay, speaking of produce, one of Europe's most bountiful farming regions is under attack. Farmers around Lleida in northeast Spain say they're likely to lose most of this year's harvests, from peaches to pistachios, olives to grapes. The culprits responsible for the devastation are rabbits. Jerry Haddon reports from the village of Verdú.
There's another one. At midday during a sweltering heat wave, farmers Ramon Bonet, Ramon Boleda, and Juan Bonet would normally be heading from their fields to the shade of the village bar. But today they're stuck driving around, counting rabbits. We spot dozens of them, scampering among the crops, darting in and out of underground warrens. We stop on the edge of a vineyard. Something here is very wrong. The rabbits have chewed the skin off the vine, says Boleda. This vine is done for. This entire harvest is lost, he says. The plantations around Lleida are sometimes called Europe's fruit basket. There are millions of dollars at stake here, as well as the supply of many farm products for shoppers from Berlin to Budapest. A short drive away, Boleda finds new losses among his pistachio trees. The rabbits eat the bark all around the trunk, he says. They've destroyed more than 400 trees. Boleda says that's about $100,000 down the rabbit hole, and the plague is getting worse. There are now up to 1,000 rabbits per square kilometer here, farmers say. 50 is the acceptable number, says the government. Everyone agrees the bunnies need to be culled. The problem is how to do it. After the drive around, Ramon Bonet tests his 12-gauge shotgun. He says rabbits have always lived in Iberia. In 300 BC, the Carthaginians named the peninsula España, or Land of Rabbits, and it stuck. So humans and bunnies have long coexisted, but recent hotter temperatures are causing rabbits to reproduce faster. And Bonet says the pandemic hasn't helped. During these years of COVID restrictions, he says, no one was out hunting. Plus, there are just fewer hunters in general. Our average age is now over 60. There are no more young people, he says, and yet the rabbits keep coming. But hunting is the only tool farmers have. Antoni Torres is the local hunting warden. He says in this county alone, rabbits have overrun 99% of the farmland. We'd need to double the number of hunters, he says, to reduce rabbit numbers. But then you create other problems. You can't have that many people with guns hunting at once, he says. We need to be able to put out poison, interjects Ramon Bonet. Either they die or we do. That's exactly what was written on a giant sign residents woke up to on a recent Sunday. It was hanging from this bridge on the edge of town. Farmers or rabbits, it read. And there was something else. They hung actual rabbits off the bridge, says a local bakery worker named Eva. Dead rabbits, to be precise, with ropes around their necks. That's a bit sadistic, Eva says, don't you think? But I do support the protests. Poor guys. The anonymous gesture attracted TV crews and sparked a minor, unexpected backlash in the village. The next day, the animal rights folks had hung their own sign, says farmer Juan Bonet. It said, to protest, you don't need to shed blood. It had a picture of a bunny giving us the finger, he says. The farmers here will keep protesting, as they did recently, driving through town on their tractors, and they'll keep suffering huge losses. They hope that if shoppers find less produce to choose from this fall, society might support them in their fight to keep rabbits in check. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Verdú, Spain.
America's war on drugs began 50 years ago. It was a global effort aimed at users, dealers, and traffickers here in the U.S. and in places like Latin America.
There is no measure by which we can say that this so-called war on drugs has had any success.
Now lawmakers in Colombia are considering a radical about-face. That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Friends to all and enemy to none. That is the attitude Pacific Islanders need to take right now as China and the United States compete for influence in the region. Henry Puna summed up those feelings. He's the Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum, which gathered this week in Fiji.
And that is the best approach for us because, you know, we can't afford to be enemies with anybody.
Joining us is Charles Edel, former advisor on the Indo-Pacific region at the U.S. State Department. He's the Australia chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Charles, what is behind this message, friends all, enemy to none?
Well, coming up to the Pacific Islands Regional Forum, there had been an enormous amount of churn, consternation, and worry within the region about what the Solomon Islands security pact with China meant for the broader region. What the PIF had done was purposefully excluded their dialogue partners. That means China, that means the United States, so that they could just talk amongst each other without outside pressure, number one, but also because there had been some serious rifts within the Pacific Island Forum. Both of those were more or less successful.
So I'm wondering, though, if it's even possible for Pacific Island nations to avoid taking sides between China and the U.S.
Well, it's not entirely possible. If we look at the distinct regions of the Pacific Ocean, we know that if you look up north in the Micronesian area, you have three states that have security compacts with the United States of America, all of which are in the process of renewing and updating those. So there is a side taken ostensibly there. There's also not the United States and China, but there's, as there has been for decades, an intense competition amongst the Pacific Island states for who backs China, who backs Taiwan, and that is ongoing in this competition.
Now, earlier this year, the Solomon Islands signed a secret security deal with China. Member states at the Pacific Islands Forum this week agreed to consult each other on any future security deals. What does that mean exactly?
Well, that means that this probably won't happen again, or at least there are now mechanisms that are in place that no state will act on its own without consulting the others more broadly. But zooming out, Marco, this is an attempt by the Pacific Islands Forum to reclaim its centrality and to make sure that actions that individual states take that might be deemed detrimental to the larger region won't happen without pre-coordination and without a chance for the other regional leaders to talk and express their concerns about any such deals.
So, Charles, would you say this agreement among the Pacific Islands is a blow to China?
I would say that this is indeed not what China was hoping for. And this is, of course, not the first time that this has happened over the last couple of weeks and even a couple of months, because Wang Yi, when he came through the region, he visited 10 out of the 18 island nations with an enormous security and economic package.
And he's the Chinese foreign minister, yeah?
That's right. And tried to get 10 of the 18 nations to sign up. But this regional accord was rejected. And this is the largest message, I think, that has emerged from the regional forum this week, which is everyone at the forum saying, this is not how we work in the region. We're there for consultations. We're not there to be dictated policy to by outside powers.
So one part of the final communique at the Pacific Islands Forum, and Australia was there in Fiji this week, pushing developed nations for bolder action on climate change, which they say is the biggest threat they face. So as we nervously watch China and the U.S. jockey for positions of influence in the region, how significant is it for the bloc to say climate change is really what you rich countries need to help us with?
Well, it's significant. It's something that they've been saying for years as their number one security concern. You know, the last thing that I'll say here, Marco, is that while the United States and China were not at the Pacific Island Forum, they weren't not there either, because in a somewhat unusual move, considering that no outside powers were allowed who are not members of the Pacific Island Forum, the Fijians invited the Vice President Harris, to speak. And she made quite a speech with an awful lot of commitments to the Pacific. And that was extremely well received there.
Right. Well, one of those commitments in a remark, she said the U.S. would be tripling funding for Pacific Islands to $60 million. China, by comparison, though, shelled out $1.5 billion in foreign aid to Pacific Island countries between 2006 and 2017 alone. That's according to Lowy Institute research. So whether it's security issues or the battle against climate change, is $60 million really enough to make friends in the Pacific?
You know, Marco, your point is well taken. China versus the U.S., if we look at aid commitments, there's not much of a comparison here, but that's just the tip of the iceberg, first of all, for what the U.S. offers. Vice President Harris, when she was there, also said that she was going to have this $60 million actually annually over 10 years. So that's $600 million that we're talking about. And if you look at a comparison one-on-one of China against the United States, China is giving more aid, or at least so we think, because China is notoriously opaque about how it reports numbers. And so part of the rollout of the Partners of the Blue Pacific Initiative that the White House has engaged in over the last couple of weeks has been to try to harness not only the interest, but really the resources of like-minded nations to make sure that they are not only good partners, but they're offering at the scale that the Pacific Island nations actually need.
Charles Edel is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you very much for taking the time, Charles.
Thanks so much for having me on, Marco.
As sea ice melts in the Arctic, accelerated by climate change, polar bears are losing their hunting grounds. Without that crucial habitat, the polar bear population begins to decline. This is all true, but sometimes the overly broad narrative misses the nuance of real animals in distinct locations. Emily Hovick takes us to one group of polar bears responding to climate change in an unexpected way.
They just went behind the...
We're in the Svalbard Archipelago, in the Arctic Ocean, about halfway between Norway and the North Pole.
They're still there.
Our guides, Timo Virma Virta Santucci and Teemu Tisari, have taken a group of us on snowmobiles to the far eastern edge of Svalbard's largest island, Spitsbergen.
I just saw two silhouettes up there.
It's a mother polar bear and two cubs, headed out onto the sea ice.
A lot of tracks. Should we go and have a look?
It's April, and these cubs were likely born this spring. Now their mother is taking them out into a changing world to teach them to hunt.
Just don't walk on the polar bear tracks. Yeah.
They learn from their parents that, okay, this is a good hunting ground. And when that is changing, then of course they're like a bit lost.
Teemu has lived in Svalbard since 2015. In that short time, he's watched the changing landscape with his own eyes.
The most dramatic change that you have is the amount of sea ice, and that you can see firsthand here. The winter is coming to an end sooner and sooner every year.
Polar bears need sea ice to hunt their primary prey, seals. They also need it to walk to their denning areas. And Svalbard sea ice is losing mass decade by decade. But the bears in the Svalbard area, they're surviving.
So far, it's a little bit like unclear what's happening.
Yeah, so my name is Jon Orsch at the Norwegian Polar Institute.
Jon Orsch is one of the foremost experts on the Barents Sea polar bear population. They live in an area that includes Svalbard and part of Russia. There are about 3,000 bears in this group. Around 300 stay mostly on land, on and near Svalbard. But all of them need the sea ice.
The Barents Sea area where Svalbard is a part has experienced by far the fastest loss of sea ice the last 30, 40 years, more than twice as fast as anywhere else where you have polar bears. Maybe you should think that it's already meant trouble for the polar bears in Svalbard, but what we've actually seen is that they are still doing fine.
One reason for this may be that these polar bears were hunted until 1973. Since then, the population has been on a bit of a rebound. But the other reason lies within the bears themselves.
Polar bears are what you call plastic. That just means that they are already designed in a way that make it possible for them to switch the way they live.
The polar bears that live on and near Svalbard appear to be hunting more reindeer and taking more birds' eggs. Mother bears are swimming farther to get to their denning areas. But while polar bears have proven themselves resilient, as the sea ice continues to melt, scientists do not believe they'll be able to keep it up.
We think there will be some sort of threshold in the future where the population will start to decline. We don't know exactly when that will happen.
But history tells us one thing pretty definitively. Where sea ice disappears, polar bears move or decline. They don't keep adapting.
You don't have polar bears where you don't have sea ice. And if it was that simple, I think polar bears would have expanded into areas where you don't have sea ice already.
Yeah, it feels...
Teemu Tisari is used to seeing these changes in his home, but it still doesn't feel right.
It feels like we're witnessing something very dramatic here. Yeah, this place will not be the same in 20 years from now, definitely not. And nobody knows what it will be like in 20 years, but something different.
One change Jon Orsch and his colleagues think is likely, those 300 land-loving Svalbard bears may die out. But that doesn't mean polar bears will disappear completely.
I'm optimistic that in the very high reaches of the Arctic, we'll be able to keep the bears in those areas.
Dr. Andrew DeRoche has worked with bears in Svalbard and all over the world. Now he's at the University of Alberta. He believes that as the Earth warms, the highest part of the Arctic, where the ice is too thick for polar bears now, will be perfect for them.
It looks like there still will be enough sea ice for them to persist. And so I'm cautiously optimistic looking forward. But that also depends on what we do now so that we can have those bears there in 50 or 100 years from now.
The higher those bears go, the harder they'll be to catch a glimpse of. So for those hoping to experience the magic of seeing a polar bear, the clock really is ticking. For The World, I'm Emily Havik.
If you're feeling a little peckish, you might want a biting of nyama choma or katogo. A biting is a common way to refer to a snack in East Africa. Nyama choma and katogo are popular dishes eaten in Kenya and Uganda. Now, I don't know how soon you will come across these words if you're a crossword puzzler, but they are a sample of some 200 East African words that were just added to the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED. I'm joined now by Bevoa Isingoma, an OED consultant for Ugandan English. He's a linguist at Gulu University in Gulu, Uganda. I want to know, Bevoa, how these words make it into the dictionary. But first, what is nyama choma and katogo? Because I've never tried them.
Oh, yeah. Choma in Swahili means to roast. Okay, it is roast meat. Katogo is a Ugandan delicacy. Is cooked green bananas, plantains, mixed with the beans or beef. That is boiled and then it is served as breakfast.
It sounds really good. These new words, I understand the OED has quarterly updates to its massive collection of words. What exactly is the process of adding these new words to the dictionary? Who decides?
Oh, yeah. It's a long process, and the decision rests on the OED experts. For us as consultants, our work is to really ensure that indeed those words, because we are people who are on the ground, like I'm in Uganda, I'm a Ugandan, I've spoken Ugandan English from my childhood up to now. So we provide information about their use. We provide evidence, okay? We provide the exact meaning. Mm. So that is our job.
So the new entries also include expressions like tarmacking, which is the action or process of walking the streets looking for work, or collabo, meaning to collaborate. I mean, we can hear the obvious connections to the English roots. So one might think, well, is that really a new word, or is it a footnote to another existing word? You're a consultant for Ugandan English for the OED, Bevoi. How do you decide which expression should be sent up for consideration?
Oh, yeah. There is one word formation process known as semantic extension. So you may have an existing word already in the English as spoken in the UK or in the US. But here in Uganda, the meaning is extended to something else, maybe similar. I'll give you an example of the word bounce here in Uganda.
The word bounce as in like to bounce a ball?
Yes. The verb bounce is used to mean like if you have an appointment with you and I come, I don't find you in the office, then I say I bounced. That's how we use it. So that is some kind of innovation by speakers of English, okay, in other parts of the world who come up with meanings which are related to the original meaning of given words.
Well, that's a great point, because English is famously a language that borrows a lot from other languages. The word cookie, that's Dutch. The word skunk is from the Native American language Abenaki. Buffet, of course, is French. A lot of these new additions are Swahili in origin. What does that tell us about the power of Swahili?
Oh, yeah. Those borrowings that come from Swahili. Of course, Swahili is a lingua franca in East Africa, even though in Uganda it is not spoken the way it is spoken in Kenya and Tanzania, but we are embracing it. The government policy now has changed, has made it compulsory in schools. So in order to have a common language, the East African community is promoting Swahili. So it is a very powerful language in East Africa, and that explains why we have many borrowings from Swahili.
Of course, language doesn't need to be in a book in order to be used every day by millions of people. What do you think is the power or significance of adding these words to the OED?
Now, this is very important. For example, when you come to Uganda, you hear, for example, the way I use the word bounce. So if you hear that here in Uganda, you say, oh, what is this? So you can go to the OED and look it up. I say, oh, you'll find this special meaning, okay, as it is used here in Uganda. We may have our own dictionaries here, Nigeria, Ghana, they already have dictionaries of Ghanaian English, dictionary of Nigerian English, but the OED is a respected dictionary in the whole world, so we can talk of independence and so forth. But linguistically, we still use English, even though we have domesticated it now. That's why we have our innovations. But still, we remain attached to English as a global language so that we can communicate freely with the entire world.
Bevoi Isingoma is an OED consultant for Ugandan English. He's a linguist speaking to us from Gulu, Uganda. It's terrific to speak with you, Bevoi. Thanks so much.
You are welcome, and thank you, too.
In Colombia, a controversial bill is gaining traction. If approved, it would legalize cocaine. That's never been done before in Colombia, or anywhere else for that matter. But as the world's TBS Isaiah reports, Colombia is soon getting a new president, and there seems to be momentum behind the idea.
America's so-called war on drugs began half a century ago.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
That's Richard Nixon speaking in 1971. The offensive brought longer prison sentences for drug dealers and users. The strategy was adopted across Latin America in a joint effort with the U.S. But did it really work?
There is no measure by which we can say that this so-called war on drugs has had any success.
Colera Youngers is an expert on drug policy with the Washington Office of Latin America.
Colombia, as well as other countries, did everything that they were supposed to in terms of combating the drug industry. And yet you find more drugs than ever before. You find more drug trafficking routes throughout Colombia and across Latin America. Drug use has steadily gone up. And you, of course, have the horrific corruption and violence.
The only winners of the war on drugs, she says, are the cartels. And those who pay the highest price are the poorest, especially women who go to prison for minor drug offenses.
Soy Patricia Merchan. Tengo siete hijos.
Patricia Merchan grew up in a dangerous neighborhood in Bogotá, Colombia. She has seven kids, and she says her family faced extreme poverty after the father of her children walked out.
No tenían alimentos para darles a mis hijos. No tenían ropa.
I didn't have any food for my kids, she says. We had no money for clothes or diapers. We had nothing.
No sabía qué hacer. No encontraba trabajo por ningún lado.
Merchan says after spending several years trying to find a good job, she didn't know what to do. Then someone in the neighborhood offered her work, selling drugs. He told me it would solve all my problems quickly, she says. So she sold small amounts of marijuana and cocaine to users in the neighborhood. Merchan did this for a few years until she was arrested and sentenced to 4 years in prison.
Tuve que dejar solos a mis siete hijos. En ese momento, mi bebé tenía siete meses de nacida.
She says the hardest part was leaving her kids. The youngest was 7 months old. She got out of prison in 2019 and helped start a nonprofit that supports former prisoners called Mujeres Libres. Colera Youngers, the drug policy expert, says drug-related crimes are the main cause of female incarceration in Latin America.
When a woman is detained for selling drugs out of her home or on the street corner or transporting drugs, the very next day somebody else is there to fill her place.
So lawmakers in Colombia are talking about trying something different. There is a proposed bill that would regulate cocaine.
It's very pioneering, it's very groundbreaking, it's very new. No one has done it anywhere.
Steve Rawls is a policy analyst with the Transformation Drug Policy Foundation in the UK. He advised the lawmakers in Colombia who wrote the bill, and he says cocaine legalization is the way to go.
People want to use cocaine, and they will use cocaine, whether it's legally regulated or whether it's sold by the cartels. There's no third option in which cocaine magically disappears.
But Rawls says this bill by itself would not have a big impact on organized crime. And that's because the vast majority of Colombian cocaine is exported to the US and Europe.
But the whole point of this bill is that it would begin a conversation. It show that it can be done in a responsible way.
Rawls says this could pave the way for other countries, including the US, to start a similar conversation. But critics like Jonathan Calkins say legalizing cocaine would be a disaster for America.
Because the increase in dependence would be far worse than the current problem that we have.
Calkins is a professor of public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He says legalizing cocaine would transform the market for the drug.
Big declines in price, big increase in potency, the proliferation in product forms, you get marketing. You have to worry that sometimes the industry controls the regulators.
In the case of Colombia, the bill would prohibit marketing of cocaine. It's unclear whether the bill is going to pass, but a few weeks ago, Colombia's Truth Commission called for the legal regulation of drugs, and the incoming president, Gustavo Petro, said he supports the idea. Petro takes office in August as the first leftist leader in the country, and he brings with him some radically different views on drug policy. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaya.
Get yourselves ready to hear more about Vietnamese singer Song Tung MTP, who's earned the title the Prince of V-Pop. He's been a hot property in Vietnam since his 2012 hit there, a song he wrote when he was 18, Con Nguyen Yang Qua. That translates very roughly as, "It's been raining since you've been gone." Over the past decade, Song Thong MTP has become an icon for the young, wired generation of Vietnamese, lucky enough not to have experienced the firsthand ravages of the war.
Thanks to technology and social media, you're the most connected generation in history.
He even got name-checked during President Obama's visit in 2016.
You're streaming the latest Song Thong MTP hit.
To the glee of the singer's fans in attendance. The following year, a 23-year-old Song Thong MTP was interviewed by music outlet SBS Pop Asia. He predicted that, in the near future, Vietnamese pop music will have a place on the map of regional music. He was not wrong. In fact, he was shooting a little low. Song Thong MTP is now making a play for the North American audience with a new single. It's a slow jam about loneliness, his first song in English. But really, Song Thong MTP needs no introduction. We leave you today with Song Thong MTP's 2019 collaboration with Snoop Dogg, Hai Trao Chao An, that means give it to me. Rap in English, melody in Vietnamese. That is our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.